Welcome to Econ on Mics, where we dive into the world of research with insightful conversations featuring six remarkable women economists from Asia, Africa, and Latin America. Proudly presented by the International Economic Association's Women in Leadership and Economics Initiative in collaboration with Women in Econ and Policy. Stay tuned as we uncover fresh perspectives and explore the global economic landscape.
My name is Anahita Karandikar, and I'm a second-year PhD student in economics at the University of British Columbia. Today, we are so excited to be speaking to Professor Kanika Mahajan. Dr. Mahajan is an associate professor at Ashoka University in Sonipat, India, and has previously taught at Ambedkar University in Delhi. Professor Mahajan has made significant contributions to the fields of gender and labor economics, many of which we'll be discussing today. As a student at the Master's in Economics program at Ashoka University, I remember that my introduction to Professor Mahajan was through the first semester course in econometrics. Your clarity of thought and ability to explain complicated, abstract concepts in simple, approachable terms always stuck with me long after the term ended. And I'm so happy to have the opportunity to discuss some of your work with you today, Professor, and share it with our audience. Before we get into the specific questions, I would like to briefly introduce the theme for today's episode. We'll be focusing on Professor Mahajan's work that is concerned with issues around the stagnation of women's labor force participation in India. So what I'd like to do is start by requesting you, Professor, to give our listeners a bit of a background on what the most interesting or noteworthy trends have been in female labor force participation in India over the last few decades, thinking about how this might differ from other settings and how you think this has varied based on demographic factors such as rural and urban settings, as well as across different sectors of the economy.
Thanks, Navika. Thanks, Anahita. Thanks a lot for having me over on this podcast. It's really a fabulous initiative, and I'm really glad to be a part of it. To answer your question, Anahita, when we look at female labor force participation rate in India, there are two things to be broadly noted. One are the low levels. So for instance, wherever you sort of, in the cross-country narrative, look at various demographic factors like fertility or education or income per capita, a lot of things that determine the overall trajectory of an economy, India almost is an outlier amongst the other, you know, Middle East countries, which also are outliers in this regard, where for the same level of education, fertility, and income, we have one of the lowest female labor force participation rates across the world. So we are in the bottom 15 of the world, which is clearly a concern, given that we're losing out a large chunk of our productive labor force, which can contribute towards the growth in the economy, and we're not using it as efficiently and as productively as we can. So one of the sheer low levels, which if I were to broadly put a number, say in 2017-18, we were around 30%, if I take into account age group of 15 to 59 years old. The second interesting feature of female labor force participation rate in the country is the trends over time. If you look at urban India, you'll see that literally last 30 years have seen no movement in female labor force participation rates, and they've been stuck around the ballpark figure of 22% to 24%. They've hardly moved by 2 percentage points over a 35-year period. However, on the other hand, if you look at rural India, there, the trends have been starker. And there, what we've seen that between 1930s to 2017-18, at least till the latter part of this decade, there was a clear, distinct fall in female labor force participation rates. And they fell from 51% in the 1980s to almost 37-38% in 2011. And in 2017-18, in fact, they had fallen to almost 28%, which is quite striking, given that we've almost halved. Over a 35-year period, we've almost halved the female labor force participation rates. Predominantly, what our work shows is that, you know, you can chop this decline down into various decades to understand what factors have contributed in each decade towards explaining the decline. And there, what we find is that in 1980s to 1990s, it was predominantly supply-side factors like changing education structure or increasing incomes, which almost explained the entire 4 to 5 percentage point fall in female rates in that particular decade. However, if you come to the next decade, which is 2000s, from 1999 onwards, from there, the supply side factors don't really seem to be playing that important a role. For instance, what we find is that at most, they can explain 40% or 50% of the decline. And at the minimum, depending on the assumptions that you make in the model, they can explain 10 to 20% of the decline. So clearly, I think in more recent times, the factors which have led to the decline have changed. So from supply side factors in 80s and 90s, we've sort of moved to more of demand side factors in 2000 and later. So that's sort of the broad trajectory of female labor force participation rate trends and levels in India. You know, just wanting to point out one more thing that struck is that if you look at the more recent periodic labor force surveys, you know, there is an uptick. So for instance, you'll find that from 2017-18, where the labor force participation rates were, as I said, 27-28%, it has moved up to 37-38% in the most recent PLFS round, which has again been a topic of heated debate amongst many practitioners. Is it clearly an improvement in female labor force participation? It doesn't seem to be, because a lot of this increase is again coming from rural India, not from urban India. So urban India has still been very stuck at low levels. And even within rural India, it's agricultural sector and self-employed, which seems to be more distress-driven, where men are moving to the other sort of sectors and, you know, moving out of the villages maybe, and maybe their women are taking care of the lands which are left behind. So it's not really a story of, you know, increased labor market opportunities leading to higher employment opportunities for women, rather than distress-driven employment, if anything. So just thought that I should point the latest trends as well, apart from the ones that I've analyzed in my work so far.
Thank you for telling us about that uptake, and also pointing out that while, you know, we hope that it's a signal of improvement, there's definitely a lot more work that needs to be done in figuring out exactly what is driving some of the more recent trends. So you highlighted in your answer kind of two main features of this. When we think about female labor force participation in India or in any context, labor supply as well as labor demand. And you talked about how in the early 1980s, 1990s, it was mostly labor supply factors. So let's kind of talk a little bit more about labor supply first. And one kind of crucial determinant of labor supply that seems apparent in your work is marriage. And so you found that, you know, fewer married women are joining the workforce. And what, according to you, do you think are like the household factors or social norms that could be contributing to why marriage could potentially be acting as an inhibitor of labor supply in contexts like India?
Yes, so there are two things here. One is that the decline that I spoke about in rural India earlier was predominantly amongst married women. So again, that points to, you know, maybe home production factors or, you know, increased incomes leading to, you know, withdrawal of women from the labor force. The second part is in urban India, where the lowest female labor force participation rates seem to be amongst the married women. So they have almost half the labor force participation rates of single women in urban India, which points that, you know, there are other factors apart from just demand, which could be driving the wedge between the labor force participation rates between married and unmarried women. And what our research showed is that, of course, there are multiple factors that affect this. One is, you know, the social norms around home production. Of course, social norms is a big thing that we, you know, we tend to use for many things, right? And like, if we can't explain something, then we try to bucket it under social norms, right? And it's definitely, I think it's become a word that has been the most disliked maybe within the gender economics fraternity of late. So to give a structure to what we meant by social norms in that paper was more about, you know, who's the primary caregiver? Who is, you know, who is the one responsible for caregiving, for child caregiving, for even for elder caregiving within the household? And there, if you look at world value surveys or other surveys, predominantly, you do find that, at least for India, you know, men think that women are primarily responsible, and even women think that they are primarily responsible for these tasks at home. And that motivated us to, you know, to look at to what extent can different factors explain the low levels of female labor force participation? Of course, there are two things, as I said, you know, the declining trend, and in urban India, more importantly, the constant, almost unchanging low levels of female labor force participation. And here we found that there were two things which were important. One was returns to education. Now, as I said, education explains a part of the decline that we observed even in the 80s and 90s, and that's because in India, what we find is that there's a U-shaped relationship between female labor force participation and education. So as women get educated, so from illiterate, suppose they go to primary education and secondary education, there is initially a fall in the labor force attachment. And then you only see a rise once they graduate and above. Now, in the literature, you know, this question has been looked at for other countries as well, in terms of what is the general pattern of labor force participation with education rates. And this varies across countries. So some countries exhibit a U-shaped relationship, while others exhibit an increasing relationship. Predominantly, these two are the ones which are observed. In the developed countries, you see an increasing relationship, whereas amongst the other South Asian countries differ. In India, we observe a U-shaped relationship between the two variables. What are the factors that can affect? Now, why do we observe this U-shaped relationship? Now, theoretically, there can be broadly, you know, two factors were discussed in the literature. One was the wage effect. As you get more educated, your wage rate increases, your opportunity cost in the labor market increases, and hence you're more likely to work or supply labor. However, your bargaining power also increases, right? If you value leisure as a normal good, then you can also increase your demand for leisure within the household. However, third factor, which had not been looked at so far, was the returns to home production. You know, how do returns to the labor market change vis-a-vis returns to home production? So if my return, so when I, you know, go from illiterate to primary educated, and if the returns to my labor market do not increase as much as my returns to staying at home, looking after my kids, investing in their human capital, making sure they're well fed, they're well educated, they're studying, you know, then it is possible that I actually see a decline initially. And it's only when, you know, I'm highly educated and the returns to my labor market are much higher that you actually see women, you know, coming into the labor force, where, you know, the returns to the labor market have increased much faster than the returns to their home production. And we find that this almost explains 50% of the U-shaped relationship that we, you know, see in India. So returns to home production are extremely important vis-a-vis returns to the labor market. So one is a demand side factor, the other is a supply side factor, right? But both are interacting with each other in a way. The second is, you know, so what about the remaining? We still are not able to explain what's happening to the remaining unexplained part. And there we found that, you know, again, social norms around who undertakes home production, irrespective of the returns to home production, also play a role. So the remaining sort of the U-shape is basically explained by the general norm. If you look at time use in India, you know, women spend 8 to 9 times more time on domestic work as opposed to men. So on an average, men spend about 20, 25 minutes in a day, right? Whereas women are spending almost, you know, 6 hours in a day doing domestic work. If you look at the same ratio for the developed countries, there's a wedge there as well. But what's the wedge? The wedge is twice, right? The wedge is not 8 or 9 or 10 times. So these kind of norms matter, because if you're going to give the responsibility to the woman, and if she's going to spend 8 to 9 times more time on domestic work vis-a-vis men, then how can you expect them to also work in the labor market and also do, you know, household chores? You're just expecting them to do too much. And yeah, so that's the social norm that we speak about in that paper. In the more recent paper, in which we wanted to understand the preferences of men for women who are working versus non-working, and then within working women, the kind of job that they're working in. So we wanted to understand that, you know, are there also things happening even before women get married? So all these things we observe once they're married, right? But are there decisions being made even before women enter into the marriage market, which influence their labor market decisions? Now, that was the main sort of motivation when we started looking at that question. And what we did is we created these profiles on one of the biggest marriage market platforms in India, these female profiles, and we kept everything constant, just changed their working status. And within the women who were employed, we gave them managerial position, like within the factory setting, which is more male-dominated, more male-identified. We gave them like data entry clerical positions, which are office-based jobs. And third, we gave them teaching positions, which are more female-dominated, sort of work that's more amenable, at least regarded as more amenable to, you know, to doing both household work as well as, you know, doing outside work and managing your kids. And maybe not surprisingly, what we find is that, you know, women who are working are 14.5% less likely to receive an interest from a male suitor on the platform. And within the set of working women, it's the women who are working in masculine or, you know, I would say more inflexible jobs are the ones which receive the highest penalty within the group of working women. Whereas those who are working in feminine jobs leave the least penalty in terms of this differential interest being shown by male suitors on the platform. So clearly, you know, I think marriage market sort of plays two roles here. One is before you get married. If you know that people or in general, working women are not valued, you know, you will not invest. Even parents will not invest in the kind of education which is more labor market oriented. And even women might be less motivated to really look for a good job before they get married. And after marriage, you have these home production tasks, these child caregiving tasks, which limit the women's employment opportunities, given the wide disparity in India between the domestic work that men and women do.
So thank you so much, Professor, for giving us such a detailed explanation of all these different factors that go into the labor supply decision of women. So one kind of thing that this makes me think about is this year's Nobel laureate in economics, Claudia Golden, has a book called Career and Family, where she describes how there are certain jobs that are greedy in the sense that they demand a lot of flexibility, but there's also a high premium associated with being able to provide that flexibility. And clearly, in the context that you just described, where women are taking on a disproportionate share of household work, they're not able to take on those greedy jobs. Where do you think, you know, what potential do you think we have for a place where we may be able to adapt jobs to be less greedy or less demanding and meet women at some of the, you know, restrictions that you just described on women's labor supply in terms of the different norms that make household work predominantly a women's responsibility? Do you think, so in terms of this, should we change norms or should we change jobs? Where do you stand on kind of the interplay between these two things as a way to increase women's labor supply?
Actually, before I answer this question in the context of India, let me like take you back to the history of the US, right? Now, in the US, the uptick in female labor force participation rate essentially happened after World War II. And the driving rate behind that was, you know, this sudden increase in demand for labor. And men were not there. Men were not available to work in the factories. But you had a lot of things which had to be manufactured, especially for the war. And that's when women for the first time enter the factory floor, where they had never worked earlier. So the norm was that women don't do factory work and women stay at home, even in the US, right? But what really pushed them in these jobs as well was this sudden shock to the economy, which increased the demand for labor, and you really needed women now in these workplaces. So yeah, so I do think that you do need change on the demand side to be able to even move some of these social norms. Because then what happens is that you've got one generation of women which got exposed to these changed norms. And now if you look at Rachel Fernandez's work, this has actually sort of gone down the generation. Because when you've seen your mother working and you've seen the kind of independence or the kind of, you know, empowerment that brings, you're also more likely to work when you reach that stage. We shouldn't look at social norms as in a silo in themselves. Because you can also have demand side shocks changing these norms. Apart from, yeah, of course, there are various ways in which researchers are trying to also change social norms themselves without changing. And that research is sort of really like blooming right now in terms of how to change social norms. Can you really do that when they're kids or once they're in the adulthood? How easy or difficult it is to change the norms around who does household work, who, whether women can take up certain kind of jobs or not, etc. Because what I feel is that Claudia Golden's work, of course, is more contextualized to the US economy, where you've got a large service sector, white-collar job. In India, however, you've got 80% or 70% people, even in the urban sector, working largely in informal jobs or are largely self-employed. So the structure of employment is very different across the US and India. So the nature of constraints, the large informal sector, In India, poses special challenges, I feel, for women workers as opposed to what exists in the US. But when it comes to white-collared workers, if you're comparing apples to apples, I do feel that having jobs which allow both men and women, here I would not want to say only women, because then, you know, that leads to discrimination, or then employers feel like, no, why only that women are being given this special sort of treatment. I think for both men and women, having jobs which allow you to balance work along with family are important. And if you're able to build a general work culture, which allows all employees, not just women employees, to be able to do, that's crucial to be able to eventually move the needle, because otherwise employers look at women as a cost, as an additional cost. And you don't want employers to look at women like that. Similarly, because we've raised, can you actually change the nature of work to be more suitable to the kind of work that women demand? One narrative that's been going around is around work from home. Right? Whether you can if we were to have more work from home kind of jobs, then can you increase the attachment of women to the labor force? I do think you can. My only worry is that to what extent will you have work from home jobs increasing in the coming years or months? Because clearly you do see that if you talk to employers, they do feel that working in office premises is more productive than working from home. Although they're open to it, certain kinds of jobs, certain employers are open to it, but there is a reservation. They do want you to come to office at least a few days in a week. And like doing completely home-based jobs is, I don't think that's going to exist, except for maybe in very few niche kind of sectors. So relying on that solely as a way to be able to increase women's labor force participation rates, I think that can't move the needle too much. It can, but not too much.
Great. I think this is also an excellent segue kind of to talk a little bit more about the next component, which is labor demand. So you brought up firms and what firms are looking for in their employers and how that could relate specifically to the demand for women's labor. We'll come back to firms, but before we do that, I think I wanted to ask you a little bit more about on the labor demand story. Can you tell us a bit about your work on how the gender division of labor in agriculture and in relation to increased mechanization has impacted women's workforce participation relative to men? And what potentially implications this has in terms of women being included in like the structural transformation of the Indian economy, more specifically.
Yeah, so actually this brings us back to the initial question that you had asked me, Anahita, on the changing trends in female labor force participation rates in the country, where I had sort of discussed about my research, at least one research, which showed that in the early parts of 80s, 90s, there were predominantly supply side factors. And then in 2000s, we don't find that these were playing that important a role. And in fact, we dug into that question a bit deeper and we started looking at, okay, what's happening in agriculture? Because this entire decline that we've seen in 2000s has been in the agriculture sector. And one thing we noticed is that that particular decade had also been marked by a 4x increase in adoption of mechanization, especially in the task of tilling. In general, agriculture in India is not as mechanized as, say, the US or the other developed countries. So in the US, you have only 2% of the labor force involved in agriculture, whereas in India, we have almost 40% of our labor force employed in agriculture even now. And that labor, and that portion is even lower for China. I think in China, it's around 15%. So there is a lot of scope for us to move our population employed in a more productive, right? Agriculture is a low productive sort of sector. And to be able to move them into more high productive manufacturing and services, which is the general way in which structural transformation happens. But I think that's been a bit slower for India as opposed to the other countries. So coming back to the agriculture sector now, so what we found is this sharp increase in mechanization, especially in the tilling. So there were two tasks which got mechanized. One was harvesting and the other was plowing or tilling. Harvesting increased by almost double, whereas mechanization in tilling or plowing increased by almost 4 to 5 times. And we then use, but then we try to find the causal impact of this uptake in mechanization on both male and female labor use in agriculture. And here what we found is that this increase in mechanization in the task of plowing almost explains 70% of the decline in female labor force participation during this time period. And we exploited the exogenous variation arising from the soil texture. Basically, mechanization or the demand for machines is likely to be larger in loamy soils vis-a-vis clay soils, because machines or the plowing techniques don't work as much as well in clay soils. And that's the exogenous variation that we exploited to be able to see what affects the uptake of mechanization. And in the second part, then what is the impact of this increased mechanization on women and men's labor use? And we only found a decline for women and not for men. And the reason behind the decline was decreased use of female labor in the operation of weeding. And that was pretty surprising for us, because you have mechanization happening in plowing, but then why is labor use falling in weeding? And what we found out is that when you use machines for tilling, when the quality of tilling is good, the growth of weeds is less. And despite the adoption in a task in which women don't really, in fact, 20% of people working in the task of plowing are women, whereas 80% are actually men. But men don't get displaced as much because the productivity has also increased, right? But it's the weeding bit which really gets affected. And we see a decline in female labor use in agriculture over this 12-year period because of the uptick in mechanization. In fact, there's also a recent paper by Namrata Kalan, which also shows something similar, in which they gave vouchers to households to be able to hire custom hiring equipment. And they also find that when it came to hiring labor use, it was only female labor use which fell as opposed to male labor use. So clearly, studies are pointing to a differential impact of technology adoption, in at least in the context of India, on gender labor use, which then has implications because the problem in rural India is that the growth in other sectors, so apart from agriculture, you have construction, manufacturing, and services. However, manufacturing has been stagnant, and manufacturing is the sector in which predominantly women work. So you're being pushed out of agriculture because of mechanization happening. However, where do you go to? Manufacturing has not increased 4%, not changed over a period of 3 decades. Services, it's increased, but it's increased by hardly 2 percentage points. Construction, now that's been the major pull for men. And you had about 12 percentage point increase in construction sector employment for men in rural India. However, these construction sector jobs are not available near home, right? So you have to travel, you know, 1.5 hours or even 2 hours in buses, in modes of transportation, which are not very comfortable for women, I would say, because I've seen them in these rural places. And hence, the uptake in construction sector employment for women has only been 3 to 4 percentage points. And hence, you see that there's been a fall in agriculture, but a very small increase in construction, almost no change in manufacturing. So the structural transformation, as the way it's happening in India, given that manufacturing is not changing, I think that's playing a very important role also in the low female labor attachment rates in the country, because that's a sector in which women globally work more. Bangladesh is a story in which the rise in female employment is largely attributed to the rise in the garment manufacturing industry in the country. So again, like the nature of structural transformation, I think in India has not been as amenable to the kind of jobs that women would typically want to work, whether you look at even Claudia Golden's earlier work, where she spoke about the U-shaped relationship between female labor force participation and income. Her hypothesis was that, no, as economies progress, the good quality kind of jobs, which women and no men, and even like the which the household's value would increase. But I think construction sector jobs really don't fit the bill.
No, that is very interesting. And honestly, I did not know this fact about the construction sector being the other major alternative in rural areas. And I think it's interesting because the fact that, again, these jobs are not available near the home, and so women are restricted in their ability to access them, goes back to some of the earlier discussions we were having on labor supply really being restricted by a bunch of other factors. So the demand and supply interactions are honestly super interesting. And you did touch a little bit upon the manufacturing sector and the fact that this seems to be a bit of a vacuum that currently remains, that's not really filled. But just thinking a little bit more on the labor demand story when it comes to firms or in the manufacturing sector, trying to think of, based on your ongoing work, what is your understanding of the factors that are influencing labor demand from the firm side, especially things like trade-offs between pecuniary benefits like wages and amenities, something you talked about a little bit before, as well as firms' abilities to support women in cases of sexual harassment, for example. So how do you think these factors play a role when it comes to labor demand? And finally, an important element that we can touch upon as we try to close is employers' preferences. So to what extent do employers' preferences play a role when it comes to demanding women's labor in manufacturing as well as service type jobs?
So coming to your first question, which was around firms and the demand side role, at least when it came to firms towards female employment, here's something that my research, in fact, my more recent research has shown, is that there is a link between a firm size and female employment in India. You can look at only manufacturing enterprises, or you can look at all enterprises. It doesn't matter. But you clearly see that for firms sized having less than 10 employees, you'll only have, say, 6 or 7% of their workforce is going to be women. However, as they increase in size, and when you reach a size of, say, 100, almost 20% of their workforce, or like 25% of their workforce, is actually women. And overall, if you look at firm-level data, around 13 to 14% are women employees. So you clearly see that irrespective of the sector, whether it's manufacturing or services, there is a clear relationship between the size of the firm and the proportion of workforce in that firm that is female. And we also know that India is infamous, I would say, not famous, for its very large proportion of small, unproductive firms. So for instance, if you look at economic census, 98% of firms in India have less than 10 employees, which means that they're super, super unproductive, right? And these are not the kind of firms that even women want to work in, because these are small firms having very bad work environment. They're not even regulated. I'm like, there is no Maternity Benefits Act, no POSH Act. They're completely unregulated in the unregistered sector. And plus, given that they're so small, they just cannot afford to invest or provide amenities like, say, transportation or childcare or other things that women value as employees. However, when firms grow in size, A, their ability to provide these services because of their scalable in nature, right? That increases. They also become regulated under different acts. There's also a compliance, especially for a larger firm. You tend to comply more as opposed to even if you're like a 20, 30 odd sized firm. And clearly there's a lot of work both in developed countries and developing countries, which has shown that women value work from home, they value pressures, they value transportation. So all these amenities which bigger firms are able to provide is something that women workers value. The other thing is that, no, even the bigger firms, why would they want to attract women employees? One is just by the fact that, you know, as they grow, they're able to provide these amenities. Second is that the task division of labor can also change. So the demand, so what we see, we extracted these skills from a service sector platform. And what we found is that as firms grew in size, their demand for complementary skills that are associated with both men and women tends to increase. For instance, if you have a small firm, you're probably only doing some data entry work, not doing much. But as you grow in size, you also want people who can manage these data entry clerks, or you also want people who can look after recruitment. You know, so these tasks, which are typically associated with women, you know, they tend to increase in demand as firms increase in size, especially in the services sector. Now, the story could be a bit different in the manufacturing sector, which could predominantly be coming from the economies of scale of production and the economies through which you can provide these amenities. But clearly, across different sectors, whether it's manufacturing or services, you do see this clear relationship between firm size and the proportion of female employees. And given that the firm size constraints are too many, of course, we have so many labor laws. We also evaluated the effect if you were to amend some of these labor laws in a way that allow or promote firm growth, can you move the needle on female employment? And here, taking the example of Rajasthan and Jharkhand, which amended their Industrial Disputes Act, which increased the threshold of firing workers from 100 to 300 workers, we find that once these states amended and increased the thresholds, which allowed firms to grow in size without coming under the ambit of regulation, increase the proportion of female employment in these states because firms were able to grow in size. So I think from a policy perspective, from a demand perspective, there is clearly, I think, good and more evidence is coming out that we need to provide good quality jobs. Now, how do good quality jobs come in? Small firms cannot provide good quality jobs. Let's be very frank about it. They just cannot afford to provide. So you have to have incentives which allow firms to grow. Having small, unproductive firms doesn't help female employment. So I think that is clearly one aspect of demand side, which is creation of good jobs. And one way to do that is to promote firm growth. Of course, there are many other ways to create good jobs. But clearly, removing constraints around firm growth, I think, can be one of the good things, which automatically also leads to provision of other amenities that we want to provide to women and which they value. The second question you had was around employer preferences, right? And there, what we find is it's pretty peculiar. So usually across the world, you cannot state whether you want a male or a female employee. But in India, if you look at most job portals, you'll be able to see that employers are able to put preferences down. In fact, this is less prevalent in private job portals where you don't have a field for gender. So what employers generally do is that in the job description, they would just insert if they want a particular kind of gender for that particular job. In most of the government job portals, you actually have a separate field, which is write the gender of the employee that you want, which actually, in my opinion, is against equal opportunity and can actually be contended when it comes to laws against discrimination in the country. However, given that we use the data and we try to see that what kind of jobs do employers want women for and what kind of jobs do employers want men for, and there we find that typical things that come up for more flexible jobs, more counseling, teaching, secretarial kind of jobs, they want women, but for traveling or like night shifts or for like delivery jobs, they would probably prefer, they have a specific requirement for men. And typically jobs which have an explicit preference for women are lower paying. So when women apply to jobs, right? So think about women applying to these jobs on job portals. Now, if you clearly have preferences given, why will they employ? Or why will they apply to a job which says that, okay, men are preferred or no, we are looking for men for this position? And they tend to apply more for neutral jobs or for jobs that explicitly mention women. But these tend to be low paying. And on an average, we find that there is about 3.5% gap in application wages on the job portal. And around 7 to 10% of that can be explained by these explicit preferences which employers are putting on this particular job platform. And remaining 17 to 20% can actually be explained by implicit association. When you know that these are that this is the kind of job in which employers typically want men, right? So you also don't tend to apply for such jobs. There may be a job which doesn't mention men, but if it has night shifts, given that a set of employers are associating that with men, or if a job requires travel or certain kind of skills, like even Python and other kind of hardcore coding skills were more associated with demand for men on that platform. So not only so do these explicit requests matter, but they also create stereotypes. And then women, even if there is no explicit request, but there's an implicit association with these words with men, women tend to apply less to these kind of jobs which demand these skills or have such inflexible work arrangements. Of course, it could be both ways as well, because employers think that take up these jobs, but that's a separate thing. When employers perpetuate that through self-statement, in a way, you're contributing to the vicious circle, which you want to break at some point of time. So that was something that we found to be very peculiar and to the Indian context. Third question you asked me was around sexual harassment, right? And how sexual harassment and women's valuation for sexual harassment and also the employer's reaction to acts such as posh can affect female employment. Now, quickly, you know, so to answer your question, what we find is that after the Posh Act came into place, so it was only applicable to employees, to firms having at least 10 employees. The firms which were closer to the threshold, they actually see a relative decline in their female employment. That's because complying to any regulation is costly. They have to set up an ICC, they have to train their employees. Plus, in general, interactions have now become costly between male and female employees. Smaller firms in general tend to apply more men than they tend to hire more men than women. And now if interactions between genders become more costly, because now a man thinks that, oh, I can be reported. And I don't want to work with a woman now anymore, because now there's a risk of being reported for sexual harassment. You can actually have unintended consequences of this act. So we actually find a decline just around the cutoff. However, for very large firms, there is no decline. Because of course, for larger firms, again, complying with this act is not costly. And there a few men cannot, if there's a demand for women. And of course, supply of women also changes, right? Because women value anti-SH policies. So you also expect that supply of women would change to these firms. So there's again demand and supply angle, which can work in opposite directions for different types of firms. So you may have smaller firms where demand may fall more than the supply increase because they don't want to comply. But for very large firms, this can actually have a positive impact. So I think we have to be a bit mindful of the kind of, eventually enterprises want to make profits, right? They don't want to be in the business if they're going to loss making or if they'll have to comply with many labor regulations. So I think as a country, also we need to be a bit mindful of what kind of restrictions are we subjecting the small enterprises to? Because that's where predominant compliance cost burden really arises. The larger firms are able to bear these costs more easily. I hope I've answered all your questions here.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, so you touched through this episode on so many different kind of aspects, both on the labor supply front, the labor demand front. We spoke about agriculture and firms. And so as we come close to wrapping up, I think my almost like final question to you would be, at the very beginning, when you outlined the different trends that we spoke about, you mentioned that after 2017, there's a little bit of an uptick, but that's possibly not something we should be super hopeful about because it's coming from the rural sector and might be because more distress oriented rather than a sustainable increase in the share of women participating in the labor force. But according to you, as a summary, given the trends we've seen so far, what policy changes or what interventions, even before we move to policy, kind of what interventions do you think, according to you, seem most promising, both on the labor supply as well as labor demand front, to truly increase the share of women we see in India's workforce, and for us to be able to make the most of this productive workforce that we currently seem to not be making the most of.
Okay, so I think this is like a very difficult question, because people have tried so many different things to move the needle, and I think most things have failed. But what I, from my at least personal experiences of doing field research, feel like, so on the supply side, I think the major constraint, so there are two constraints actually on the supply side. One is the general sort of thing where households don't want their women to work. You know, some households are like that. Now, moving the needle on them, changing those social norms are super difficult. However, there's another set of households which are okay with their women working. But as long as the work at home gets done or if the childcare is proper. And I think for these households, it's easier for policy to come in and make a dent. Because here, if you provide good quality childcare, where the households can reliably send their kids to. Now, in the developed countries, basically the childcare market is a huge market. And that's a market in which predominantly women work. And it's also a market where women leave their kids and they go to other kinds of work. So developing that kind of market, because we clearly know that childcare is a constraint. Now, some women may be able to get work from home jobs. Not all can. Not all are in sectors which are amenable, and not all employers are going to be okay with full-time work from home jobs. So you have to have an ecosystem where provision of childcare is easily available and good quality childcare at reasonable prices. The issue is that in India, the wage rates are very low, right? So if you look at a woman, say a woman who's just had class 12th education, the typical kind of earnings that she can get is about 15 to 20,000 a month, right? Now, in that kind of earnings, where does she leave her child to? So it also becomes a cost trade-off, and be able to get that kind of... So either you have very good privatized childcare, which is extremely costly, or you have very low, bad quality government childcare, which actually doesn't even exist in the urban areas. It probably only exists in rural areas to a certain extent because of the Anganwadi system. So I think there's clearly a gap there, which if filled, can really give a boost to female employment. The second part where I feel that we can move the needle from the demand side is creating good jobs. Now, one thing I did not mention, because that paper never saw the light of day, but we keep trying many things, and some things we are able to write up, the other things we're not able to write up. But what we also saw between 2011 and 2017 is that the places where the male unemployment rates or where they rose the most, female workforce employment, because females generally don't say that they're looking for work. They'll just say that they're working domestic work. The female labor force, the female workforce attachment rates fell the most. When there are limited jobs, when they're scarce, when the jobs are scarce, men tend to get the first right to those jobs, right? I mean, even if you look at World Value Survey. So A, creating more jobs, but more importantly, creating good jobs, not relying on unproductive informal sector kind of jobs, but having more manufacturing jobs, I think becomes critical to be able to get women who are leaving agriculture or who are leaving these traditional forms of employment now into the formal. Because even the services sector employment, people keep, you know, as economists, we keep harping about the increased contribution of service sector towards income generation in the country. But if you just look at the contribution of service sector towards the proportion of workforce, that's only moved by 2 percentage points in last 3 decades. So while, yes, the contribution to income has become 5 times, the contribution to employment growth has just not been that much. So again, so that's where I think creating good jobs, good quality jobs, promoting firms to be able to find it in their interest to be able to have female employees and to be able to provide them these amenities, I think is going to go a long way to be able to move the needle on female participation in the workforce.
Thank you. That was very well put. As a final takeaway for our listeners, do you have any recommendations for the readings on this topic?
There are so many people doing excellent work in this area. So some of my colleagues who are doing fabulous work, like Ashwini Deshpande, Anisha Sharma, Prajna Dasgupta. So all of us work in the area of gender and labor. A lot of our work is at that intersection. Worldwide, I think there's a lot of work being done. I think more recently, there's work by Lisa Ho. And I think you're also working on Aita on a few projects related to gender and workforce. So I think there are many researchers. I will probably fall short of names right now, so let me not do that. But there are many researchers. Seema Jayachandran is there. There's Rachel Heath, who's worked. There's Farzana Afridi at the ISI. So many big names who've been working in this area for a long time, trying to see what works in the labor sector. And there is Rohini Pandey. You know, I think they have a bunch of things going on along with Charity Moore on being able to move the needle using a financial sector inclusion. And I think a lot of those projects also look very interesting because, again, NREGA is one thing which I didn't talk about, but it does have potential for the rural sector. So yeah, I'm like, all this is more recent work, but maybe if I have to say one book or one resource that I have loved reading and which has motivated my entire thought process in general towards labor and gender, more specifically, is the work by Esther Boss-Roop. So she wrote this book called Women's Role in Economic Development in the 1970s. And that's like a treatise. It's like a bunch of 100 hypotheses in that small book. And so nicely written, very small sample sizes, and of course, no causal work. But just the descriptive work is so illuminating. And there are so many things there which have still not been tested. And she's been able to hypothesize about the relationships between wearables and what drives women's work. And of course, Claudia Goldens, I think all her papers are a mirror into what is really going on in the US. She has some of the most fantastic work when it comes to gender and work in the context of the US. Apart from, I think, these economics kind of textbooks, which we, of course, keep reading, I think some of the books which I've liked more recently is one, it's called Invisible Women. That's a text that I would recommend a lot of people to read. The other is a book that my husband actually gifted to me, which I've just started reading, but I'm enjoying it. And it is Women Who Run With the Wolves. So it's, again, about women being more ambitious. I think that also drives it. So a lot of times you're able to overcome hurdles at home by how you deal with them. If you're motivated enough and if you really want to achieve something, then feel free to go again some of the things that you may face within your homes and outside as well. I hope listeners enjoy these resources. But there are many more. So there are too many resources here.
I think in your final thoughts, not only did you give us recommendations, but you also managed to inspire us with that final thought. So thank you so much. I wish we could keep talking for longer, but unfortunately, I will have to draw this episode to an end. I would like to first and foremost thank you, Professor, for taking the time to speak to us today and for sharing such valuable insights. I'm sure this was a great introduction to the study of women's labor force participation for listeners who are new to this topic, but I'm also sure it's left those like me who've been reading some of this work for some time and are hoping to contribute to it with so much to think about. So thank you so much for your time. And finally, thanks so much to all our listeners for tuning in today. We hope you enjoyed the episode.
Thank you for joining us. A special thanks to our brilliant speakers and interviewers for their valuable contributions. Share your favorite moments using the hashtag Amplifying Voices and stay tuned for more impactful discussions.